It's the Burt Cohen Show.
You still there? Oh, good.
Will the dream go on? I don't know about you, but I'm more than a little bit frightened by what's going on to erode the very basis of our country, the foundation of America, the Constitution. Are we now headed into a post-constitutional era? What is happening to America? How serious is this? The national security state, the surveillance state, are our freedoms as defined by the Bill of Rights in what kind of a threat? How serious is it? There have been other, you know, erosions of our Constitution in the past, but we bounce back with that. Well, I'm very pleased to have with us today our guest, Peter Van Buren. Peter, you there?
Yes, absolutely. How are you today, Bert?
Oh, not bad, not bad. It's sunny in the seacoast, which is nice. Well, Peter Van Buren blew the whistle on State Department waste and mismanagement during Iraqi reconstruction in his first book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. I don't think it's all your fault. There's a lot to go around. He is a Tom Dispatch regular. He writes about current events at his blog, We Meant Well, and his new book, The Ghosts of Tom Joad, Story of the 99%, is available now. Well, again, thanks for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. And you say, one September morning, our post-constitutional era began amid falling towers and empty skies. And in an article titled, What We've Lost Since 9/11, Taking Down the First Amendment in Post-Constitutional America, you write, quote, America has entered its third great era, the post-constitutional one. Okay, Peter, what were the first two great eras?
By post-constitutional era, I'm referring to what's happening now in the United States. Our first era, if you will, was pre-constitutional. This was the time when we were a British colony, back before America declared its independence. In that period of American history, we suffered injustices under the British. We had very limited free speech. We were often punished. We Americans were often punished for speaking out, right up into things like the Boston Massacre, where Americans were gunned down by British soldiers. We found that the British could use what were called general warrants, which allowed them to search any American's home to take anything out of those homes, papers, documents, possessions, without suspicion, without any reason, without any specific warrant. We also found that Americans were punished extrajudicially. The governor of the British colony could simply decide what punishment was appropriate when Americans stepped over these lines. Those challenges, those injustices, were all specifically addressed in the second era of America's constitutional history, and that is the constitutional era, when through the creation of our beautiful Bill of Rights, almost which I call almost a haiku of a people's government, each and every one of the British injustices were addressed point by point by point. And that brought us into a period of 220-some years where, with bumps and horrible things like not addressing the slavery and the rights of women and Native Americans for some time, there was at least a sense of forward movement, a sense of progress, a sense that even if we couldn't fix all these problems or resolve them all quickly or even completely, we were trying to move in that direction. Those are the first two eras. And that's brought us, Bert, to this third era.
And in what ways, as you write, is the current third era of the United States similar to that first one?
Well, we've almost come full circle in many ways. In pre-constitutional America, our governance was by a unitary executive who ruled from afar, the king in that case, the King of England, and whose goal was simply to preserve and concentrate his power over us. And there were no real rules that restrained him. Anything that did work, if you will, any rights that Americans did have were granted by the king and otherwise did not exist. In post-constitutional America, we are headed into, if not already into, a similar situation. It is the unitary executive, the White House, in this case under the guise of President Obama, but he's little different in this sense than George Bush was, or perhaps the next president will be. In what rights Americans have are often those the government decides to allow us to have. Free speech? Sure, as long as you're in a designated free speech zone half a mile from the event you're protesting. Free speech? Sure, as long as the government wants to release documents or tell you what you want to know. Free speech? Sure, if you're a journalist that writes down what the government tells you to write, no problem. But if you're Jim Risen from the New York Times or James Rosin from Fox News and go against the government's lines, you find yourself prosecuted. These are hallmarks of post-constitutional America.
Wow, some very, very scary stuff. And growing up in the 50s, I never would have imagined us being where specifically we are. I certainly have been to my share of protests through the years, protests against America's war in Vietnam, and we had an effect. We absolutely had an effect trying to save lives there, save American as well as Vietnamese lives. And it seems like the government learned from that. You know, I mean, they restrict press coverage back during the war in Vietnam. The press was everywhere, and it brought the war directly into people's homes. The government, the powers that be, learned from that, learned how powerful something like democracy can actually be when people get to participate in our own self-government. What was the original purpose of the Bill of Rights? You know, how did that come about? It was in the context of this tremendous centralized power, yes?
Absolutely. And you can go back to the Bill of Rights and simply walk through it amendment by amendment. And each part of the bill addressed a very specific injustice that the British were forcing on Americans. One interesting way to kind of prove that point is to look at what I call the Forgotten Amendment, the Third Amendment. And I'll pause here just for a moment, as if we were on Jeopardy, Bert, and challenge your listeners in their own minds to remember from high school civics what the Third Amendment was about.
Okay, you got me stumped.
I hate to put you on the spot, but do you want to take a shot at it?
I know what the second is. The fourth? I give up. What is it?
The Third Amendment says that the government cannot quarter troops in a private home without the owner's permission. Now, this is no longer a particular issue in the United States, but during the pre-constitutional era, the British had a habit of knocking on Americans' doors and saying, you will now take in five British soldiers, you'll give them places to sleep, and you'll feed them and take care of them, and you'll get no payment for this, it's simply something you're ordered to do. And the founders said, no, that is wrong. And they wrote the Third Amendment specifically to say the government can no longer do that. In a way that illustrates the whole picture, because when we can argue about, and some people do, well, what are the rights under the Second Amendment in particular? That's a controversial one.
Yeah, yeah.
Or even now, with the revelations from Edward Snowden about the NSA, what are the rights Americans have under the Fourth Amendment to privacy against unusual search and unreasonable search and seizure?
Very much in the news, yes.
But I like to pick on the Third Amendment because there's no argument about that. The colonists were put on, the founding fathers wrote a specific amendment to address that, and the government has followed that. There are no concerns these days that American soldiers are being forced on suburbanites in their spare bedrooms. And that is what the Bill of Rights is all about. It is not about what Americans can do, which is often how it's mischaracterized.
Mm-hmm.
It is about what the government cannot do. And that's a very important distinction. The Bill of Rights doesn't grant rights to Americans or privacy or free speech or to own weapons. It specifically prohibits the government from doing certain things, such as stopping Americans from speaking freely or stopping Americans from having privacy. And that distinction, Bert, I think is critical to understanding the discussions as we go forward with the Snowden revelations and others.
Yes, very interesting. We have rights that precede government, natural rights, human rights. And
this
takes them for granted and recognizes that the founders of our country wanted to secure those rights and protect those rights. And they had lived with an intrusive government forcing itself on us. So, as you mentioned, it's specifically stating what the government cannot do. And, boy, it seems like there's a heck of an erosion of that these days. If you just tuned in, our guest today is Peter Van Buren, who blew the whistle on State Department waste mismanagement during Iraqi reconstruction. In his book, We Meant Well, we're talking about post-constitutional America, this third era of America. That's pretty some scary stuff. One of the first flashpoints that you write about that started the upheaval against the tyrannical king was the Stamp Act. Now, we've all heard of the Stamp Act, but probably remember it even, well, maybe a little better than the Third Amendment, which you mentioned there, and you got me on that one. What was it about the Stamp Act and its enforcement that caused so much anger in the colonists?
It's funny how these things all interconnect over time. And at the end of the day, what matters most is history. In pre-constitutional America, the British Parliament, thousands of miles away and cut off from the people, much as many people feel Washington is today, passed a law called the Stamp Act. And even though this was over 220-some years ago, it's still relevant to our discussion today. The British basically said that you're going to pay taxes on all sorts of imports, including important stuff that Americans liked back then, molasses and tea, and some other odd things. And more importantly, the British were going to have permission to search any American's home or business, with or without suspicion, with or without permission, to make sure that no one was getting around these taxes. And these were called general warrants. It was basically a hunting license. The British could basically shake down an entire city street in Boston, for example, going house by house looking for whatever they might find. And while ostensibly their task was to make sure you weren't cheating on your import taxes, in reality, if they found subversive literature or whatever was offending them on that particular day, you were in trouble. The Founding Fathers understood how intrusive that kind of government action was, the allowing government to basically search citizens at their whim, and wrote into the Fourth Amendment a specific protection against that, saying that the government of constitutional America can only search under what they call probable cause, which was defined later by the Supreme Court as the likelihood that some type of crime had been committed, and with a warrant that was issued by a court. That means specific permission. In constitutional America, that worked very, very plainly. The police would have to have some reason to believe that, for example, I had drugs here in my apartment. They'd have to go to a court and explain in detail how they came to the conclusion that I had drugs in this specific apartment. The court would either agree or disagree. And if the court agreed, they would issue a warrant that allowed the police to come to this specific place and search for that specific thing. It wasn't permission for the police to go through my car, my office, my business, my wife's locker at the gym, whatever. And it wasn't permission for the police to look around and see if they could find anything else that might be a problem. That has nearly evaporated under the revelations that we've gotten about the NSA, where essentially technology and government will have evaporated the concept of warrants and plunged us back into a warrantless state.
Wow. NSA spying. And this is something that it's been interesting to me. The normal divides, left, right, Democrat, Republican, don't really apply to public reaction to National Security Agency metadata gathering, spying on all of us, and their capability of using drones, the legality of drones. I mean, I have seen drones, and it's very creepy. It's really creepy, because they can peer in windows. I mean, it's like exactly what people were concerned about at the time of the War of Independence. And what concerns me, perhaps more than anything, is the seemingly acquiescence of most of the public in this. That, people often feel, well, I don't have anything to hide, so what? We have this new concern since September 11th. There's a new national security state. You know, is it, all these protections, they're 18th century protections, very quaint. Don't 21st century security concerns and requirements really trump those old protections?
You know, it's interesting. The founding fathers were brilliant in their ability to forecast, despite changes in technology, why our rights were so important. Let's go back first to that your statement about if I've got nothing to hide, I've got nothing to fear, because that's often, both by people and by our politicians and alleged leaders, trotted out as something of a palliative for all the warrantless spying and all the intrusions into our life that the NSA is making. Hey, if you're not on the phone with terrorists, why does it matter if we listen in on your conversation? You know, if we know you're just talking to your mom about cat videos on the internet, it's no interest to us, and we'll move on. The answer to that, of course, is twofold. The broader answer is embodied in the concept that we discussed just a few moments ago, that these are inalienable rights, and these are, in the Bill of Rights, what the government cannot do. It doesn't really matter if you care about your privacy or not. You are entitled to it. If you don't care or you do care, it's irrelevant. You get it. It's required. It's inalienable. It's built into the system. It's the default. The other point to that, of course, is the idea of everyone, of people believing they have nothing to hide. Glenn Greenwald, the amazing journalist who has been writing about these national security issues for years and years and years, and of course recently has become an international figure because of his work with Edward Snowden's revelations,
yes,
often answers the question about nothing to hide by inviting anyone who believes they have nothing to hide to come up to his podium, write down all their internet passwords, and give him permission to publish anything he happens to find in their accounts. Give him permission to go through their medical records, their emails, their banking records, their tweets, their social media, the Snapchats, whatever, everything they have online. Just give him permission to root through it and publish what he wants to. And if you're willing to do that, then perhaps truly you do have nothing to hide. Glenn mentions that in months of making that offer, no one has actually taken him up on it. We all have not so much things to hide per se, but things that we wish to hold private, things that we will choose to share maybe with a spouse, but not with our boss, or even vice versa. And that is the essence of all these things. I think an important point is to remember who first uttered the statement, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. It was first said publicly by Joseph Goebbels.
Oh.
Adolf Hitler's propagandist and one of the people who enforced the national security state that the Nazis put into play. And if indeed our democracy is dependent on recycling phrases from the Nazi era,
yikes!
I suspect we're in trouble.
Boy, can it happen here that, you know, people say, oh, it could never happen here? Well, you know, police state is something that obviously Germany had in the 30s and 40s and the old Soviet Union had, which was not really communist. It was just, you know, a fascist police state, really. What was the police state? I mean, our founders understood the concept of a police state. What was the police state that they worried about and created measures within our foundation to protect against? What kind of a police state did they have experience with and tried so hard to protect us from?
The founders clearly understood what it was like when a government had absolute power or near absolute power. They right. feared this type of government. In every single word of their documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution itself with its checks and balances, and particularly the Bill of Rights, were written as both a warning and a buttress against the government they were creating becoming this way. And they understood what could happen. They saw colonists shot down in the streets
right.
by British troops. They saw houses taken over. They saw what happened when government had the ability to basically kick in any door, seize any property, search through anybody's things. And they understood it in a broader sense. It wasn't just that, okay, you know, my door has been kicked in, my stuff has been taken, and maybe I'll get in trouble for some of that, though those are serious consequences. They understood that for a democracy to exist, people needed to be free of those things. You can't have free speech when you're worried that the government may bust into your house and seize your emails where you're discussing with others issues of the day or what you want to protest mm-hmm. against or your mm-hmm. thoughts on particular political events. The amendments overlap. They support each other, and the colonists saw how these pieces fit together. If you don't have the right to privacy, you can't really exercise the right to free speech.
Mm.
If you can't exercise the right to free speech, then you can't speak to the government or criticize the government or, in fact, participate in a democracy. It all works together, and they were prescient in understanding it.
Yes.
And it remains a fearful thing to me to see that chipped away at under the false flag of protecting America.
Protecting us all. And, you know, I think about the various protests that have been through the years, and you mentioned early on about having, you know, free speech zones. And now the so many police across the country are getting, oh, they don't want to call them tanks. But hello, they're tanks. They are tanks.
Sure.
You know, in small towns, and then people also are, you know, they're aware of this. They also know that the government has used torture and has used and is justifying drone-led assassination of Americans. The administration is defending that. A lot of the public is quite acquiescent to that. Where is the outrage on these things, these protest zones and you know, drones, use of torture? There are some groups protesting, I guess, but what about the mainstream media? Are they just taking all this without a fight? Where is the outrage on this?
I wish I knew, Bert. I wish I could.
Darn.
I have come to call what's happening here participatory totalitarianism. But America is a unique country, and I hate to use the word exceptional because it's
right.
become such a bludgeon among our politicians. But in fact, there is something that was exceptional about America, and ironically, we may still be exceptional. We were the first country that was created based on a set of ideas. obviously the Greeks had evolved democracy. The word comes from Greek, but it was an evolution. It was a series of actions and things that led to that form of government. America, after winning the War of Independence against the British, had no government, and we simply created one. We simply started from scratch and made one. And that does give us a sense of exceptionalism. The fact that we appear to be participating passively or in some cases actively in the destruction of that same government makes us exceptional. I can't think of another example in history where the people have so willingly given up rights that had been so bitterly fought for over the years. We are indeed an exceptional nation.
We do have those rights still in law. And I know the ACLU, for example, recently put out a report. They did a survey about police militarization, and it's very, very troubling. I mean, an awful lot of, frankly, illegal, apparently unconstitutional deployments of SWAT teams and raids that police have done, and you don't hear very much about this. It just seems to be accepted. And it is surprising how people have been so quiet about it. And you talked about, I want to talk about whistleblowers and about the importance of reporters. You know, we just had an anniversary of some of the Watergate, reflections. Nixon resigned in 74. And what about the press these days? You write that, under Obama in specific, you write, all government agencies have regulations requiring employees to obtain permission before speaking to the representatives of the people. In other words, journalists. What the heck is that? All government employees have to obtain permission? How did that come about? And is that not censorship? And does that demonstrate that real official censorship of people in government has become the norm?
It's almost as if, the answer, how did it come about? With the stroke of a pen, Bert. The government, since 9/11, has been seizing back, if you will, rights that had stood in America for hundreds of years. And I'll make sure that listeners understand that those rights stood up through periods of incredible difficulty and danger to the United States, far beyond whatever terrorists might try to do to us. We went through civil war, we went through depression, we went through two world wars, and everything in between. And those rights stood up, and they ebbed and they flowed, and there were problems. Certainly, McCarthyism and some of the ways that Lincoln temporarily suspended habeas corpus during civil war. They're exceptions, obviously, but they were short term. Right. And focused, and not as we are stand here now, 13 years. I suspect if we were to somehow get Dick Cheney to ever tell the truth on anything, some kind of miracle drug,
right,
or something, and we asked him, what do you think about all this? I think he would say, if we knew it was going to be this easy to take these things away from the Americans, we would have done it years ago. I think Americans have been tricked, cowed, and frightened into agreeing to all these things. I live in New York City. 9/11 was one of the most horrible days of American history, and you can't walk through this city without some reminder of it. But it was a day, and the 3,000 Americans who tragically lost their lives that day have been long eclipsed by the 4,500 Americans who lost their lives in Iraq and the thousands of Americans who have lost their lives in Afghanistan and other places as part of the so-called war on terror. This perpetual state of war and the idea that we can fight battles with drones and robots now creates the constant level of fear, and I'm afraid that, that much of our media simply rolls along with it.
Yeah.
I was interviewed recently on CNN about the situation in Iraq, and the question was, what should America do? And I quickly explained America should not get militarily involved, and the host said, well, I don't accept that. And let's turn to our military analyst here, who's going to explain the importance of airstrikes.
Yeah.
And it was a quick breath, and
Wow. Boom.
I mean, literally, boom. We were back at it.
Wow.
The absence of aggressive media remains a fearful thing.
Yes.
And again, not to play the same song over and over again here for you, but to go back to the founders, in the First Amendment, they particularly and specifically singled out the press for the freedom to speak freely. They didn't just say, Americans, you could open the window and shout whatever you wanted or assemble and protest the Vietnam War or fracking or whatever was on of concern to you. They specifically gave a role to the press in all this, having understood the value in their day of pamphlets and handwritten circulated documents. They saw the press as the voice of the people and also the ears of the people to contact government, to write about government, to ask government questions when, you know, the 300 million of us can't drop by a press conference and poke at the spokesperson. For the press in America to throw that amazing role aside in so they could chase ratings, so that more anonymous government officials can leak more breaking news to them, shocks my conscience, and not to be crude, makes me almost nauseous.
And I'm sure Thomas Jefferson would feel the same way. He called him, you know, the press the fourth estate, and he emphasized without question how absolutely essential to maintaining a democracy, to maintaining a republican form of government, government of, by, and for the people, there has to be a press. I can't remember the quote, but it was something about how that was even more important than government. Really, you have to have that freedom of the press. And
Jefferson said, oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, you probably have the quote.
Jefferson said two things. First, he said an informed citizenry is essential to a democracy.
Yes.
We have to know what's going on. Otherwise, how can we decide what to support, what to oppose, who to vote for? And the quote, I think you were discussing, Jefferson said, if I had the choice of
right.
a press without a government or a government without the press, he'd choose the former,
right.
a press without a government.
And as you
showed how important, yeah.
As you mentioned, Goebbels and the Hitler administration, they understood this extremely well. One of the ways that they got power and kept power was by keeping the truth away from the people, because probably a huge percentage, I imagine a large majority of the German people, did not know what was going on. They were kept in the dark specifically. And to keep people in the dark specifically, we've seen it now, you know, the manipulation of the press. And the contrast from now until not very long ago in 1971, the press whistleblowers, you know, in our American history, they've been seen as brave heroes. We love whistleblowers. They've been heroes. And Daniel Ellsberg absolutely stands out as one. He told the truth about Vietnam. He leaked the truth. The New York Times was praised, not by the Nixon administration, because they had something to hide, but by the world, all across America. He was kind of a hero, really, for revealing the truth about Vietnam. And the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and the Washington Post had the guts to publish this stuff. And, you know, they showed that the government was, in fact, lying. And that was tremendously liberating. The press showed that. Yet, fast forward to 2008, the same New York Times squashed a thoroughly researched and documented story about Bush and Cheney and their illegal, warrantless wiretapping program. They had the information, and they felt pressured. They were just like, oh, yes, boss, whatever you say, boss, to Cheney and Bush. Tell us, if you would, about this incident and what it says about the state of the press. And it helped make sure that Cheney and Bush kept their power and glided through the election of, I guess it was 2004, actually.
In that period of time, two very brave reporters at the New York Times, James Risen and Eric Litchfield, had received information from their own sources inside the government that the NSA, with the president's and Dick Cheney's permission, had embarked on a dragnet-like warrantless search of American communications. The full technological power of the NSA, which previously had been directed at foreigners who may or may not have tried to harm the United States, but at least were outside of America, was turned inward. They literally turned the antennas around, so they pointed at America's heartland and began reading our communications and listening to our phone calls and collecting data on us. The New York Times had that story, and under pressure from the Bush administration, spiked it, refused to run it. The Los Angeles Times independently had come to much of the same information. Criminally, the New York Times held the information through the 2004 election,
right,
and only published it after the election, after Bush had been reelected, when this information may have in fact caused Americans to understand who they were reelecting and perhaps choose to move in a different direction. James Risen is worth mentioning. He's still at the New York Times. James Risen is currently potentially facing prison time for refusing to reveal a source. Risen's book about American warrantless searching and the rise of our national security state had a brief chapter about U.S. intelligence efforts to undermine the Iranian nuclear program, and was sourced to a government official, and the government turned on Risen and said, "You have to tell us who you spoke to," and in fact accused him as a reporter of participating in the crime of leaking classified information. Risen dug in his heels, refused to reveal the source, and the government prosecuted him and pushed him through a number of courts saying, "You're going to reveal your source or you're going to go to jail." Risen appealed to the Supreme Court, who only recently refused to hear the appeal. And the issue now is pending before the Attorney General of the United States, whether or not he will throw one of America's premier journalists into jail for refusing to testify at a trial the government is holding for the person they think leaked the information. Now, whether Risen himself goes to jail or not is important, but not really the point. James Risen is a very, very brave man. He has the resources of the New York Times and lots of lawyers behind him. The point of all this is not to take Jim Risen's head, but to put that head on a stick so that lots of other reporters and journalists who don't have that courage and don't have those resources understand what happens to them if they stand up. The easiest voice to silence is the one that never speaks. Self-censorship is a lot easier for the government to enforce than active censorship. And these attacks against individual journalists, and there are more of them, Jim Risen is just sort of the celebrity case, if you will, are part of what a police state does. Look at the old Soviet Union. Look at the current Russia. Look at China. Look at any totalitarian government, and you see these hallmarks being played out. And if, in fact, the United States is now comparable in this sense, or at least participating in the same processes that North Korea does and China does and Russia does, I'll suggest that's not particularly good company for a nation that once was the world's preeminent democracy.
Yeah, the world has looked up to us. Our strength has been for who we are, our constitution, our rights, not because we can beat everybody else up, because of our constitution and our rights. And that's really eroding it. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Peter Van Buren about the disappearance of our constitutional rights, how it's been steadily, intentionally eroded. No question about that. And, you know, it seems, in addition to clamping down on the press. Well, before I get to the question of our education system, which is important, I wonder about the Obama administration in particular. They're in the midst of a wide-ranging crackdown on leakers and whistleblowers of all sorts. Are they intimidating reporters and whistleblowers more than their predecessors? It sure looks like that to me.
It is an unprecedented attack against freedoms of speech, particularly against whistleblowers. The Obama administration has prosecuted 8 times as many whistleblowers as previous administrations going back to Richard Nixon, and has prosecuted overall more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all previous presidents going back to 1917 when the act was passed into law. And this is not by accident. This is quite intentional. Whistleblower prosecutions under the Espionage Act involve a fair amount of effort by the Department of Justice and involve an extraordinary amount of legal word twisting in order to turn it around and say that someone who has revealed government malfeasance is in fact a spy, right, in the way those words are defined. This sends a very chilling message. And at the risk of talking about myself, I can use my own case as an example. When I came back from Iraq after working as a State Department diplomat for over 20 years, I wrote a book, We Meant Well, that you referenced at the top of the hour, that blew the whistle on the State Department's failures in Reconstruction in Iraq, and ironically predicted much of the things that we see today going on there. Rather than saying, maybe this guy's got a point, or at least let's take a look at what he has to say, the State Department instead attempted to prosecute me, began to persecute me, and eventually tried to fire me on trumped-up reasons until the American Civil Liberties Union and some of the same lawyers that are protecting Edward Snowden today stepped in and allowed me to negotiate my own departure from the government on my own terms. Well, I didn't leak any classified information. That was never in question there. I didn't really say anything that wasn't available in other places, but I did put it all together in one place. So the State Department prosecuted me and eventually pushed me out of the organization, not because of what I did, but because of what I did. It wasn't so much the information as the need to set an example, to make an example of me, to make sure that the next person who thought about blowing the whistle thought twice and maybe decided, I better keep this to myself. And that's the same thing with these other prosecutions. These people are not spies. Stephen Kim, a State Department employee who recently was forced to plead to escape a lifetime in jail under the Espionage Act, basically told a reporter that North Korea was a really nasty place which had a very strong military that they someday might use. Not exactly earth-shaking material. John Kiriakou, who is a whistleblower currently serving time in federal prison, simply announced that the CIA was torturing people, and he knew this based on his own 15 years as a CIA operative. These people were not spies. They didn't help the enemy. They didn't make money off of revealing information or any of the traditional things that spies do. They tried to inform the American people about what the American people's government was doing, that informed citizenry that Jefferson talked about. And the Obama administration went after them with every legal, and even some extra legal tools that were available. It sets a chilling effect, and it scares people, and it causes other folks who may not have that level of courage to step down, to be quiet, to become, forgive me, good Germans.
Yeah, absolutely. As a kid, I knew about a good German, and I was determined never to be a good German, which means, of course, you know, shutting your mouth and not challenging horrible things. And, you know, you referred to the Espionage Act, which was in 1917, and that's still known as one of the ugliest periods of American history when this Espionage Act was used against thousands of people who had nothing to do with espionage. And the fact that we're resurrecting that, the Obama administration is using that heinous act, it's just, it's amazing. It's being, you know, it's thoroughly discredited. It's being dredged up and used again. I mean, they're, as you say, they're not committing espionage. And I find it fascinating. There's a person I know that, well, I used to like, who said of Edward Snowden, he ought to be lined up against the wall and shot. People are buying into this. These guys, I mean, to me, he didn't do it for the money. He did it because he saw what was going on and he told about it. That would have never been said years ago. And this government obsession with secrets, we used to think Nixon was you know, crazed about secrecy. This Nixon had nothing on this guy.
Nixon was an amateur.
Absolutely. And I have to quote, there's a guy that Nixon very much did not like, John F. Kennedy. I gotta read a quote from John Kennedy from April of 1961. He gave a speech at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in your fair city. He said, "The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there's little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it." And he goes on about there's a very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. Kennedy was, you know, fairly conservative at the time, but he understood this. And this thing about secrecy and this, you know, for some people to call Obama a liberal, they have no idea.
Again, Benjamin Franklin, one of the founding fathers, was very clear about saying those who trade liberty for security end up with neither. When you look at what has been exposed, what secrets whistleblowers and a few journalists have exposed in this post-constitutional era, it's very, very difficult, even under the most ironic liberal definition of the words national security, to find anything in there that seems to be necessary to keep secret. You know, that the U.S. government was torturing people. The people who were being tortured sure knew what was happening.
Right.
The people in Abu Ghraib who were being tortured and mistreated sure knew what was happening. What was the purpose of keeping that secret? Well, arguably, it was to prevent American citizens from knowing. Spying on Americans? Why was it necessary to keep that secret? So that we didn't know what the government was doing. We have to confront the reality that we are heading into an era where our rights are available to us when the government wishes to let us have them. And this answers another trope that's out there, which is, you know, look, I'm looking out the window right now. There's people protesting something. I wrote an email to the newspaper complaining about some government action. No stormtroopers have kicked down my door because I read subversive literature or what have you. And of course, all those things have truth to them. What that line of so-called reasoning doesn't account for is that the government, in fact, is doing those things to people, and simply by allowing you to read what you want in your home while taking away that right from maybe me jeopardizes us all. It is not, America is not and will not plunge into, I believe, a Stalinistic type of society where the bad guys are hiding behind every tree, and you know, if you even speak out about the lack of potatoes in the store, you'll be sent to a gulag. No. That's not an American form of police state. The American form of police state is what's evolving right now, where the government selectively allows and takes away rights from its citizens. It creates the false impression that most of us still have freedoms, when in fact, turning the Bill of Rights on its head, it's not what preventing the government from doing things against us. It's basically what the government now, out of its own goodwill, allows us to have.
Wow. That's not the way it's supposed to be. That is certainly not what our founders intended, the government saying, well, we'll allow you to do this. No, our rights precede the government. And as I'm listening here, you know, I'm trying to think of who is speaking out on this. Obviously, the ACLU has been defending this. They understand, I mean, the name, American Civil Liberties. We're talking about civil liberties, the right of privacy. And I have to say, I don't hear a lot from mainstream Democrats on this. I hear from people who call themselves conservative talking about this more than anything else. I mean, there's a guy running for governor of this state of New Hampshire, Andrew Hemingway, who's talking about the increase and of the NSA and how we as a state should not participate in this. I don't see a lot of Democrats talking about this. I mean, Bernie Sanders is speaking about it, and I hope he does run for president. But, I mean, certainly not Hillary Clinton. Are the Democrats missing this entirely? Are they figuring this is not an issue people care about? What's with the Democrats?
I wish I had a great answer to your question. You're throwing out some of the key issues of perhaps our time. And I have no good answers. Look, there's a couple of theories on this, of course. One is that politicians simply want to get reelected,
right,
and as long as they keep banging away on hot-button issues such as guns and same-sex marriage and abortion, which are important, rights.
Yeah.
But they treat them almost as distractions. It's not as if many of these politicians hold these issues so strongly, as much as they know it stirs up voters. And by taking a dramatic for or against stance can attract folks to listen to them and vote for them and maybe give them their support.
Meanwhile,
the other thing, of course, is the influence of money.
A very
small percentage of Americans donate most of the money to our politicians, and that gives them a measure of control. The third idea that gets kicked around, and this is the one that sometimes keeps me awake at night, and in a post-constitutional era, I argue that paranoia starts to become an unused word, is that if the NSA is spying on everyone and reading everything and listening to everything, does that not grant them enormous power? Does that not grant them enormous sway over controlling what people say and do in public? If someone knows about all the naughty things that I might be doing out there in the world, I actually live a boring life, but that's we're talking theoretically. Couldn't they, in fact, influence me? We call it blackmail in other circumstances.
Oh, yes.
I don't know which of those three all three or maybe other things help keep the discussion off of our front pages, help keep our politicians quietly going along with all this. But I'm afraid that something is. How can people's government, how can elected officials simply ignore an almost daily assault on the Constitution and the rights of their constituents? There's going to be a reason, and I fear when we learn it.
I just have to say, there was a little ray of hope on June 25th. The U.S. Supreme Court unanimously protected traditional privacy rights when it comes to the ability of police to search cell phone records without a warrant. That was unanimous. I thought, so there's a little bit of hope here and there, at least in the remarkably conservative U.S. Supreme Court.
I hate to be the Debbie Downer of interviews, but I'll say something a little bit negative and maybe a little bit positive. The negative side is, of course, this affects local policing. It affects street-level law enforcement.
But
and the court very clearly avoided any larger issues connected with the searching of individual cell phones.
Good point.
That said, the progress on this is not only some progress on street level law enforcement, which is important, but perhaps ever so slightly, the court has come to understand that changes in technology are requiring us to realign some of our thinking on these laws. The essence of the Supreme Court's decision was that cell phones are not objects. The police are allowed, when they arrest you, are allowed to search your backpack to make sure you don't have a gun in there. And that logic had been applied to a cell phone. It is an object that the police can search. The court said that this is not an object per se. It is essentially a tool, a portal, a key into your whole digital life, which for many people is their whole life. That could potentially set up other legal challenges to warrantless searches of Americans' digital lives. But those are court cases yet to come, and we're going to have to keep the book open before we're ready to say this is as significant a change as perhaps some have led us to believe it might be.
Well, we will see. Peter Van Buren, if people are interested in following you, and you have that book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. How else can people follow your writings?
There's a couple of things. First, as I have a second book out, this one called Ghosts of Tom Joad.
Mm-hmm.
And this book deals more with our society and our economy, particularly how we came to be a nation of the working poor, the 1%, the 99%. The other is to follow me on my blog, wementwell.com, where I discuss national security issues. Lately, I've been talking a lot about the unfolding events in Iraq, and where I'm offering, through a series of articles, almost a preview of the book I hope to have out next year, which is going to be called Post-Constitutional America, and chronicles, amendment by amendment, what we've lost since 9/11.
Wow. Thank you very much, Peter Van Buren. Very, very enlightening, and hopefully traditional America can survive. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Bert.
Looking for his freedom and a life of his own, but the freedom that he found.